Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning. Welcome to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. You're going to love today's show. By the way, we are going to be podcast on eddiemayfield.com and on iTunes following today's broadcast. And we are streaming live on biz1190.com. So check us out there. Our guest today is Rich Russikoff. Rich is an old friend of mine. He's a business coach, has a long history in business. And like I said, a long history with me. Rich, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thanks, Eddie. I appreciate the opportunity.
Rich, you have been a business coach for a long time. And for a lot of people, and you had a long career even before that, but tell us how you made that into a career and a business. How did that come about?
Well, I had a business for 10 years, and I'm a third-generation business owner. And when I sold the business, I became interested in how businesses changed hands. And I joined a franchise called VR Business Brokers. And that was a franchise where you work with buyers and sellers to determine and to help them find the business opportunities.
Right.
And what I saw was, I saw people buy lemons and turn them into lemonades. And I saw people buy lemonade and turn them into lemons.
Right.
And in the process, I became very successful in bringing buyers and sellers together, and I was asked by the franchisor to work for them and coach the business brokers and the owners of the franchises how to do this more effectively. And I absolutely loved it. I'm a natural teacher, and I love to teach, and I love to coach, and I enjoy working with entrepreneurs, and I broke out on my own. It's the only time I didn't work for myself that period, and I broke out on my own, and I just love every day working with entrepreneurs and helping them grow.
You know, I first met you. You were actually speaking at a business growth conference down in Florida many, many years ago. I think for Inc. Magazine had sponsored it, the old Inc. Magazine, and that's where I heard you speak and first met you. And then I should say that we've used you at our company, especially back in the formative years of our company, to help us sort of establish ourselves and grow. It was interesting what you talk about, the idea that some people buy lemons and turn them into lemonade. I have seen that as well. We've had some experience with that ourselves. I think of a guy I used to work for out in Texas that had built a very nice company up to doing about $15 million a year, so a nice little business. And he sold it to a much larger firm, and I was asking him how that went. He was joking around. He said, you know, they did great. They took a $15 million $15 million a year business, and in 2 years, they turned that into a $3 million a year business. He said just almost overnight.
Eddie, as you know, when you bought another company, when you did your first M&A, you hadn't really done all the homework you needed to do.
Exactly.
And it took a while to turn that around. And I praise you for being able to do it. I remember you sent me up there to take a look at what the issues were, but some of the issues in buying a business that most people don't look at is truly what the numbers are and how you're going to leverage it and work together as a team, and the thoughts of because you're going to put two companies together, you're going to have economies of scale, do not always happen for a whole host of reasons.
You know, you had told me something a long time ago that I've actually repeated in several different contexts. We were talking about, I don't know if you were talking about something I had done, and we were just in conversation about someone else, but you had said that in your experience, in almost every negotiation for, I think we were talking specifically about buying a business, you said you always ran into two or three things that seemed like complete deal killers, and it just seemed like that was going to be it. But you had to sort of have the fortitude to stand there and work through them. And I see that in almost any business negotiation, even if it's a large project or something. You always run into something.
Yes, Eddie, you can take that beyond a negotiation of a business, and it's clearly setting the expectations of the process. And what happens, what I used to tell a buyer and seller after we were at the point where we had the deal negotiated, and now we had to take it to close, that we're at the equivalent of the 20-mile point of a marathon. That's the halfway point.
Yep.
And there will be things that will happen, and because we are problem solvers, we will overcome them. And this way, when the first catastrophe occurs in the process of getting to close, we laugh and we say, oh, yeah, this is the first one, right, Rich? As opposed, oh, my goodness, this is going to fall apart. So anytime you are looking at anything you have to execute that has some complexity to it, setting the expectations, you know, in your business, when you go out and look at a project, it may not be what you think it's going to be until you get there.
And it seldom is, actually, yeah. But you know, I think that's actually encouraging, because if you know ahead of time, if you sort of realize ahead of time, look, we're going to hit some, this is not going to all go smoothly. We're going to hit some bumps here, and we're expecting them. There's a bit of encourage. It's not quite so devastating when it happens. You sort of, okay, we were waiting for this. And I think it encourages you to work over it, when otherwise it really might just sink the deal. It might kill the deal otherwise.
Yes.
If you just got completely. Hey, Rich, you had.
In a business relationship, if you don't set the expectation in advance that things may happen, we're problem solvers, we can solve it.
Yeah, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you and I both have another mutual friend here in Atlanta that you've worked some with, and I don't know, he told me a long time ago, he'd been with a large company that did a lot of very large projects off and on. He used to tell me, he said, you know, there are worse things than losing a project. One of them may be getting a project you shouldn't have. I think we all have been there.
True. That is so true. That's probably what Stan.
Yes, yes.
It's so true, because it's all about making the best choices as you go. And certain projects can sink you, or do you have the capacity to handle it? I'm working with a client right now who grew tremendously over the last year, and he put more and more demands on his people, the service company, an IT company. And they took on the challenges, but it wore them out. And he just lost 4 very good people, and that's a very expensive loss. Sometimes saying no is the critical ingredient to success.
You know, I relate to that. As you know, you and I have discussed this. I relate to that so well. We've had, in our company in the last year, we had tremendous growth. But since we do sell equipment, but we do a lot of, as you know, we do a lot of service, which is basically, if you boil it down to its most simple form, you're selling hours. That's what you're, and the same thing your IT guy's doing. You're selling hours. And you begin, at some point, and we've bumped up to this, I think. At some point, you really are beginning to wear your people out. And at that point, you've really got to, like you said, you've got to step back and say, okay, we have got to tone this down. Because the truth of the matter is, if you run your guys off, what have you got left? If you're doing that, you've destroyed your business. So it is one of those things that I think business owners have to really step back and take a hard look at.
And there's a couple things, if you look at it philosophically or strategically, well, who are your really good clients?
Right.
What are some of the projects that you wish you didn't take, and what did you learn from that in terms of margins, in terms of how a project will bring you to another level? I was talking to someone recently who has a deal with Whole Foods, and she is working with the Whole Foods store in Austin, which is their landmark store.
Right.
And she was telling me, I was saying, well, how are you doing with it? She says, well, the thing is, we're not making money on it right now because they pushed us so much on the margin.
Right.
But we may get the opportunity to go national with it. And I said, fabulous. How much money will you lose then?
You know, you know, in our company, I don't know if you remember, but you actually helped me with something. This has been a long time ago. We had and I'm not going to name any names here, but we had a major customer. It was actually a chain. They had a chain of distribution outlets that we were doing service work for. And it was our primary customer. It was our number one, you know, taken on a national level, it was our top customer. But as we began to have some profitability issues and we began to look at that, what we figured out was they were taking all of our time, almost all of our resources, and we were making literally no money on them. And we had to make a conscious decision. And this is a tough decision. It's very hard we didn't fire them as a customer, but we did de-emphasize them. And we said, okay, we're going to not spend any more time. We're not spending any more time on these people. We're looking over here for more profitable forms of revenue. I'm very glad we did that because it was heading down a very bad road, and we stopped it. And we do almost no business with that company now, although we still do a little bit, but we don't emphasize to them at all. They're just not, for the way we do business, it's just not profitable. I think it's what you're talking about. I think people have got, business owners and leaders have got to figure that out. You've got to look at what you're doing.
Yes, and to take that a step further, you should look at types of clients, an A client, a B client, a C client.
Right.
You want to look at those clients, and this certainly is easier with profit centers. But look and see, where are the margins? Where's the sweet spot? Where's the return? And if you don't manage your margins and you don't have transparency in your numbers, you can very easily be deceived. And any money you're making from one client or one product, you can lose in another. And that means having clarity in your financial statements so that you have real numbers to look at. Because as you grow and you go into different profit centers, what happens is if they're all blended together,
right,
you really don't have a clue.
I want to talk to you about finances later on in the program, Rich. You may remember you and I spent a couple of long days and the end of the evenings actually going over, digging into our financials, because I was back then I was losing money. I couldn't figure out why and what it had. I had a large project that was sort of hiding everything else that was going on. We have a lot more to come on Driven to Business today. Our guest is Rich Russikoff. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We'll be back in just a moment. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. Our guest today is Rich Russikoff. Rich is a business coach. Rich, give us your website address and so forth so people can find you.
Okay. It's Rich at Coach to the Best.
Coach to the Best.
Yes. That's why, once I started coaching you, I knew I was there, Eddie.
I can understand that. I can understand that. By the way, there will also be links to Rich on the eddiemayfield.com. You can find them there, but also it's Rich at coachtothebest.com, you said, right?
Yes.
Okay. Rich, you had a great career in business, and you've been involved with so many. You're one of the busiest people I know. I don't know how in the world you keep up where you are from day to day, frankly. Tell us a little about I find a lot of your early stories. I was kidding you about this off air, but I find a lot of your early stories and stories about things that you've done very interesting and kind of lessons learned in your career. I wonder if you could just share some of that with us.
Okay. First of all, when I started the business, I had no idea that I was going to end up in the jewelry and gift business on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. I started with recycled clothes, a little bit of jewelry, and some natural foods from a store that went out of business. And it was the jewelry and gifts that really took off. And so being flexible and recognizing opportunities is a key thing that helped me be successful. But one of the things I had to learn, and it was to really look at the numbers and manage the margins. I was on a buying trip in New York, and one of my vendors said, I want you to meet this accountant. He was a terrific guy. He took a look at my financials. I said, I don't want to talk to an accountant in New York. I want to have some fun while I'm up here. But I met with him. He looked at my numbers. It was my second year in business. And he said, your people are stealing from you.
Wow.
I said, well, how can you tell that just by looking at my numbers? My people love me. He said, well, maybe that's why. And what he showed me was the importance of looking at margins. I went into this business with totally ignorant of what I was doing. I thought if you bought at 5, you sold at 10, and by magic, you made profits.
Right.
What I've learned later is you make your money in the buying. And I'll share that story with you next. So what happened was, he said, you need systems in place, because there was my cost of goods were so high relative to my sales. And that's because there was in-house theft. And he put systems in place so I was able to know when inventory was ordered, let's say I ordered 6 rings from a company. First of all, did 6 rings come in? Or did 5 and they charged me for 6?
Yeah.
Or did 7 rings come in and they charged me for 7? And then I was able to see what was on the floor, what was sold, and if something was missing, we knew automatically, this was before computers, that something was missing. And we let our salespeople know that. And they knew, we now knew, if something was stolen.
Right.
So that virtually eliminated. In selling jewelry, we also learned you only put out 3 pieces at any one time so you can keep track of what's out there to prevent external theft. But here's the key story. We had a display by our register where we had somebody decided to put some little rings up there. And it's a seasonal business. It was on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And we got a letter in the fall. And in the letter was a little ring. And this lady said, I have never stolen anything in my life. But I don't know what happened. I saw this ring. It was lovely. And I decided, and I took it, and I couldn't live with myself, and I wanted you to have the ring back. Now, I'm sure I lost that person as a customer because they somehow would think I might know who they were. But the real lesson for both of these situations is we as entrepreneurs have a responsibility not to make it easy for people to be tempted.
Right.
There's a difference between flaunting and attracting people to something. So the Oscar Wilde quote that I love so much is, I can resist anything but temptation. So what we need to do is, I see it in so many organizations, people steal $150,000 from a company, and no one knows it because they have access to the financials.
Right.
Look at your numbers. Make sure that you have checks and balances, not just one person having control over those numbers. It's so easy to take anything from toilet paper and pens to substantial amounts of money. And if you don't check, for example, if people are on the road and they have a credit card, what goes on that card? You are not taking the responsibility of keeping honest people honest.
That's a very, very, very good point. As I think, honestly, you know, one of the things that I think I came to this putting systems in place thing kind of kicking and screaming because it's not my natural bent of doing things. I'm more of an off the cuff kind of person, but I did learn the hard way that, you have to, and not that you have to be militarily rigid or anything, but you need to put systems in place that those systems do run the company. And so if you're not there, this is the way that we do invoices. This is the way we do payables. This is how we do whatever, whatever you put in place, and be pretty strict about those systems so that we don't have an opportunity. People are not only not tempted to steal from you, but if you don't do it also, you'll just find, in my case, earlier on in the business, when I was gone all the time. You come back and you find, you know, on dealing with customers, you come back and find half the things you did didn't get invoiced because they got put in the wrong, you know, there was no check and balance about just matching up, you know, service orders to invoices. And I just think simple things like that are things that so many people do overlook, and you're exactly right.
And Eddie, exactly what you said about putting things on invoices and structures in place, people really do want structure. And there's those things don't show up on your profit and loss statement that
right.
you didn't bill somebody for something. And those are the hidden costs of business.
Exactly. They certainly are. And you know, another one that you and I have talked about many times, and I've talked about on the program here a number of times, is what a lot of guys forget about. They tend to have a sales bent by getting a job, you know, get it done, all that. If you don't have some kind of collections mechanism in place, unless you're a cash and carry business, you know, where you're going to get the money right there, and our business is not like that, as are a lot of businesses. If you don't have a structured collections in there, that's going to eat your lunch eventually, because you're going to find out somebody's 120 days out, and that pretty much means you're not going to get the money. With that, really,
that's exactly right. The further out it goes, the longer it's going to the likelihood of you not collecting is there, and of things being forgotten. So that means you have to have a good financial person in place. And you need to talk to that person.
Right.
You need, and that reminds me of another lesson learned.
We have about 30 seconds here before a break, but go ahead.
Okay. Should I tell it after the break?
Yeah, let's do it after the break, and that way we'll have, I'm going to give you plenty of time. I don't want to cut you short on this. I do like this whole concept of systems. Again, I came to it a long time, but I finally did get there. You're listening to Driven to Business. Great guest today, Rich Russikoff. I'm Eddie Mayfield, streaming live on biz1190.com as we speak, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Glad you're here. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Our guest today is Rich Russikoff. Again, you can find Rich at rich@coachtothebest.com. And also there'll be links to Rich on eddiemayfield.com, where the day's program will be podcast. We're also on iTunes, by the way. You can go there and look us up. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. And here's the greatest news. Isaac just told me there's actually an app. It's called, just go to the iTunes App Store, download Biz 1190, look that up, and you'll be able to hear us live wherever you are in the world. So check that out. Again, we're talking with Rich Russikoff today, longtime friend of mine and business coach. Rich, you had some other lessons you were about to tell us about before the break when I so rudely interrupted you, and I apologize. But I don't apologize, but still, we had a break. But I'll get you to tell us a little more about some other things you'd learned.
Okay, and there's so many directions we can go. The one thing I wanted to say is my website is coachtothebest.com.
Coach to the best. Okay, sorry. Coach
yes.
to the best.
Yeah, RichieCoachToTheBest is my email address, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody had. I used to go to market and ask what's new. And one day I was working with a vendor that I had a very good relationship with, and he had a line of jewelry with multicolored stones for the line, including tiger eye and mother of pearl and onyx and turquoise and malachite. And he had this one stone that he tried called rhodochrosite. And it's a pink stone. And for some reason, it wasn't selling. All the other semi-precious stones were doing very well, but not rhodochrosite. So he said to me, I'll give you all of the jewelry that's rhodochrosite, if you'll take it, at half the cost of wholesale. And in addition to that, I'll give you the whole summer to pay for it.
Wow.
Because my seasonal business. And I took it, and we did some research. Rhodochrosite means rose of the Incas. We put a magical spin on it. We did a terrific display of it, and we sold it like crazy.
Wow.
And the lesson I learned from that was, look for the margins. Instead of saying what's new, what do you have that you can give us a very good price on? And that's really where you make your money. You make the money in the margins and in the buying.
I had made a note, even while you were talking here, to reiterate something you said earlier about the secret is in the buying. We've had on here recently a guy that has a retail guitar store. That's also true to him. You've in order to make any money selling guitars, you've got to buy them at a good price. We're in the electronic motor drive business. When we resell a drive, it matters a great deal what we pay for that drive. I mean, I can't sell it to you at a really good price if I buy it at a terrible price. I mean, we have to negotiate that. And sometimes, again, even in our business, we find little, you know, they've got an overproduction run on something or something like that, and we're able to, you know, get that at a bargain. Or we can buy, instead of buying one, we can buy 10. And by doing that, we get a real break in the price. And you're exactly right. It is in. It's the buying. I think it is amazing, Rich, how many people don't know that, though. I find that surprising that people don't know that.
Well, you know it now because you've learned and seen the difference.
Right.
And that's one of the key things to look at. Where are the sweet spots? Truly, where are the sweet spots, and how do you make them work for you? Because it all boils down to the spreads of your margin. And that leads me to something else that I think would be interesting and challenging to the business owners that you're working with. And it's the power of small changes. Let's assume you have a $10 million company. And by the way, there aren't many of them.
Right.
But let's assume you have a $10 million company and the rules apply across the board, and you can raise your prices by 1%
right.
Somewhere. If you and you're bringing 10% to the bottom line, you just added $100,000 to your bottom line.
Right.
And if you can cut your cost of goods by 1% and your cost of goods are 50%, you've added $50,000 to the bottom line.
Right.
And if your sales, general, and administrative expenses are 40% and you can cut that by 1%, just small changes, you've now brought $40,000 to the bottom line. So 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 19, or 19% profits to the bottom line just by being able to make small changes. And I'll give you an example in the service world we're in. I was working with a client, and he was bringing $100,000 to the bottom line. And in his business, he was billing out 149,000 hours with the people that were working on projects. And I said to him, I said, David, what if you raised your prices $2 an hour? Could you do that? He said, I believe I can. Now think about that. That brought an additional, in this case, $275,000 to the bottom line.
Exactly.
And so the difference between one of the things I like to tell, and I do a seminar, Eddie, on creating a culture of profitability. And I say Ben Franklin was wrong. Ben Franklin said that a penny saved is a penny earned. But in reality, if you bring 10% to the bottom line, if you save $100, it's the equivalent of having to make $1,000 to bring that 10% to the bottom line.
Right.
I hope I'm not making that too complex for people to understand on the first take.
You're not making fun of us people in Georgia, are you? Because we can't have that. No, I think that, Rick, I think it's a very powerful concept, and it's a concept I do understand. The power of, you know, when you simplify, they're most powerful things are simple, aren't they? I mean, it seems that way.
If you can keep it simple, then it can apply across the board.
You know, Rich, we had in our company, as you know, we charge an hourly rate, and we've had to face this same thing many, many times about, you know, in today's climate where there's some cost pressure on things to go down, except for wages and benefits and cost of doing businesses are not being forced down. That's being forced up on most of us. And so you have to face the profitability of that hour of service that you're selling or however, whatever kind of business you're in that you're doing that. And we've had to make the calculation before about if we raise our rate by this, will we lose any customers? And the answer is probably you will. What you have to weigh, though, is, okay, if it lowers the number of hours incrementally that we're selling, but it raises the profitability of the hours that we're selling, that's a pretty good trade-off, really. And you can't go crazy with it, but that's a pretty good trade-off. If you're getting more money in, and even if it costs you a customer or two, it probably still a good deal.
It boils down to doing the math.
Yes.
And once you do the math, if you take the time to do it, you'll make more intelligent choices.
And isn't a lot of business, I know as you come in and coach many of us in business, isn't that really the bottom line you're coaching for? Is it the guy? You're not going to come in and run an electronic motor drive business or a software business or a hardware store or whatever it is the guy's doing it. You're coaching. What you're trying to coach that person to do, whoever's leading that, is to make more intelligent choices. Isn't that really your goal in the whole thing?
That's really what it boils down to. To help leaders become better leaders and know where to put their focus.
Speaking of that, in your view, when you see, and we're probably running through the break, we have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, but at least to get started with, what primary factors do you see in a business leader that when you kind of look at that guy, you think that guy's going to probably make it and be successful? Over the years you've done this, is there anything you can put your finger on in that?
Yes. I look for a lifetime learner. What I find is the best leaders are the most coachable. I look for some humility, someone that says, I realize I don't know what I don't know. Someone that knows how to play to their strengths and delegate. And delegate is what you have to do to grow a team. And in doing that, delegation is a two-step process. There's a difference between delegating and advocating.
Absolutely, there is.
Yes, and I know you're up to a few last seconds in this segment.
No, we have a couple minutes yet.
Okay, so when you delegate, what it really means is that you have to have that person follow up with you to make sure they've got it done.
Right.
And there's a difference between micromanaging and effectively managing and letting your people make some mistakes. I forget who it was I learned it from, but someone talked to me about the 87% rule, that if your people are getting it right in what they're doing 87%, and the 13% that they do it, it wouldn't be the way you would do it, but still works, it's okay. Let it go.
And I think that goes, the ability to do that goes back to what you just mentioned a moment ago, humility. I'm sure you've read Jim Collins, as have I, and he talks about, I think it's a great book called How
Good to Great.
Good to Great, yes. Yeah. Well, Good to Great, but also he has a book after that called How the Mighty Fall. And the number one way he says that he's, both companies and leaders fail in there is what he calls hubris born of success, basically arrogance born of success. You think you have had some success, so you think you know everything, so therefore you stop learning because you know everything.
And what happens is you get that sense of the Midas touch. When we were in Inc., we studied the companies that made the Inc. 500 list, and 18 to 20% of the companies that make the list historically are out of business in 2 years.
That was something that was so surprising to me. Rich, hang around. We've got another segment coming up right now. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Great guest today, Rich Russikoff. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome to the last segment of today's Driven to Business. Great guest today, Rich Russikoff. Rich is a business coach, and again, that's at coachtothebest.com. I got that right, Rich? Coachtothebest.com. And by the way, there will be links to Rich, as I mentioned several times, on eddiemayfield.com. Plus, today's program will be podcast there and on iTunes, and as I'm constantly amazed at other places it pops up on the internet that I never heard of, but it just shows up there. So that's all. That's the power of the internet these days, Rich. It sort of overwhelms all of us, I think, at one time or another. Well, the next program with you, I actually want to talk to you a little bit about what you think of all this. You and I are both old enough to have seen this thing kind of emerge. You mentioned earlier you didn't have computers. I bought a computer shortly after starting the business, but I think it was a 10 megabyte hard drive, and I was wondering how would I ever fill that up? You know, what would I ever have that would fill that up? And now we're walking around more stuff than that in my pocket on a phone. It's absurd, really. Rich, we were talking before the break. You were sort of sharing with us what you see makes people successful. And I really do like the term lifelong learner. I always tell people, you know, that I may not be much of a leader, but I'm a great student of leaders. I like to watch leaders and see what they do. And I've made enough mistakes in my own business career that I can pretty well tell anybody things not to do, and so I can be a great example, even if it's a negative example. But you mentioned the idea of humility. I do take off on that. I don't know what else you may want to share with us about that, or what you see as perhaps on the opposite side of the coin, things that can really sink somebody.
Okay, well, first, let's go back to the idea of why these companies that were so successful go out of business.
That, by the way, that was an astonishing thing to me when I found that out. Attending an Inc. conference, and I went back the next year, and some of the people they had on the stage, these big giant growth, and I had read they went bankrupt. I was like, how could a company grow like that and go bankrupt? It made no sense to me, but it does, but it happens.
Well, here's what we learned, and here's what I see time and time again. It's not the economy, it's not the business, it's not the ability to raise capital, but the critical decisions you make at each stage of growth. And what gets you to one level will not get you to the next. And sometimes sad part is that the people that work so hard to help you grow when you were in that mission stage, you outgrow them. The business, not you personally, but the business outgrows them. And you need to, at that point, make some very difficult choices.
Right.
And what also happens that early on, you're so overwhelmed with appreciation of people doing good things that you give them titles and opportunities that are beyond their true capability to perform. And that is a true dilemma for entrepreneurs. That letting people go that have been so good in one sense, but no longer have the skills to grow with the company, or you've given them responsibilities above and beyond their capability.
That's great advice. That really is. As we both know, I've been in that spot, as have a lot of people.
Which leads to another thing. I believe hire slow and fire fast. If someone is a cancer in your organization, get them out. So often when I've worked with companies, we've started by saying, well, I don't know if I should let this person go. I want to let this person go. And what I came up with was a rule. I said, if 90 days from now we're still talking about this and you haven't let that person go, I'm not going to talk to you about it anymore. I want to focus on strategy. I want to focus on you growing your business, not being caught in a drama triangle between you and somebody who may or may not be a cancer to your organization.
That's, again, great advice. You know, in my case, and this, I'm not going to name any names, and the examples I'm thinking of are far back in the past. And so, but you know, and you had told me this once, and you may not even remember it, but you had told me I had a very, very skilled technical person. It was just a problem as far as culturally in the company, and he was costing us customers and doing it just because of other things. But he had these wonderful innate technical skills that I really admired. But that was, and I think you had told me I was placing much too much. I was giving those technical skills much too much weight, is a way to put it, and ignoring some very obvious factors that were really destroying us as a company by allowing this person who was really a problem inside the company. And he wasn't, he was a bad guy. He just couldn't get along with people. And I have kind of learned from those days. And now, you know, when we hire techs now, we do need technical abilities. It's very important. But we weigh that in with some other things. And I have gotten, I hope at least, a lot smarter about that. And you know, and in our company, as it is with most companies, you know, if a person is there 3 or 4 months, you know in your gut that guy's going to make it or not. I mean, you may want to rationalize and do this and do that, but we've all sort of, kind of what you said, we'll say, look, we're going to still be saying this 6 months from now, and nothing's going to be different, and we're still stuck in the same position. We've got to deal with it.
You know? And here's what, to add to that, I can't recall a situation where, of the many, many companies I work with, where they finally have let someone like that go, and there's all this fear around how will the other people on my staff feel about my letting them go, where the staff said, why did you do that? What the staff generally says is, what took you so long?
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. I can't either. I can't think of any time we've ever done it that we've later come back and said that was a big mistake, let that guy go. I can't recall a single time that's ever happened, actually, even though we agonized. And you know, on the one hand, I don't think you should be so cut and dried. I remember a guy I worked for in Texas years ago. We had to fire a guy who just was incompetent. He's a nice guy, but just incompetent. And I just agonized over, and I almost at the point of wanting to cry about it. You know, when I came in and we let the guy go, and my boss at that time came in and said, what'd you do it? And I said, yeah, and I said, but I just feel horrible about it. And he said, well, you're supposed to feel horrible about it. He said, if you don't feel horrible about firing somebody, something's wrong with you.
You're a person.
Exactly.
Now and then you can set somebody straight. There was a company I was working with, and they had somebody that was a rising star. And within 3 years, they paid him what normally would have taken 10 years to get to.
Right.
And within his level of skill, he was being paid maybe 25% more than anybody in the industry.
Right.
And then when he wasn't able to get a pay raise, his whole attitude changed. And he became a cancer in the organization. And I sat down with him and I said, look, wherever you go, you're going to take yourself with you. And the fact that you were able to get this much revenue this soon, consider that found money. And you're at the top of the game and you're about to lose it because the CEO is going to let you go because of your attitude. So you make the decision. What do you want? And he said, do you think I can make this turned around with the CEO? I said, yes, let's go in the office and let's talk about it. And he turned himself around. But he just needed a reality check, which, by the way, is another thing that I think is so important. As much as I am a strategic coach and I work on the financial side of the business and I help people determine the best directions for them to go moving forward, I find we spend so much time on the people side of the business.
Absolutely.
And so it's really important to know how to get the most out of your people. And it isn't money. Money is important, but psychic income is what's critically important. And psychic income is catch people doing something right.
Rich, you've been a fabulous guest. I want you to stick around for next week's program. You've been listening to Driven to Business. So we're going to make this part one of Rich Russikoff. You won't want to miss him next week. I'm Eddie Mayfield. You've been listening to Driven to Business. See you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.